coming to you live from inside the globe, perched high atop the Bugle Planet building in sunny Gotham City. It's Hey Kids Comics with two guys who are always ready to seduce the innocent, your hosts, Andrew Farmer and the Jedi Cole Houston. And now it's time for Hey Kids Comics.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to Hey Kids Comics. Holy Batman. I am Andrew Farmer, with me as always, the other host of this show, the Jedi Cole Houston. Jedi Cole, are you out there?
I am indeed. Good evening.
Good evening. We are blessed tonight. We are blessed tonight to be graced with the presence of a Batmanologist. Is that the proper terminology? Batmanologist?
I believe that's what Webster's put it down as.
Well, you know, they say that you should always be yourselfologist unless you can be Batmanologist.
Damn it, it's too early for this. We literally just started.
In case, always be Batmanologist.
Thank you, Michael Cross, for joining us tonight.
Yes, thank you very
Resident
much.
Resident Batmanologist.
Fans of the Rancor Pit Live may remember Michael as a guest on our sister show that invaded the Rancor Pit Live, the Gorn Arena.
Oh, you were on the Gorn Arena. Okay, that explains it.
Yes.
I know you, but you don't know me. You have me at a disadvantage,
I am also a
sir.
Star Trekologist. So.
Oh,
that's
then
right.
I need to talk to you about some other stuff later because I have many bones to pick right now and also heaping praise. But well, that's not this show. That's another show.
That's Hey Kids Star Trek.
Yeah, that's my...
Damn it, Jim, that topic's dead.
That topic's dead.
Oh, wow.
What do you... Damn it, Jim, I'm a Batmanologist, not a... Can we...
That's right.
But speaking of Batmanology, tonight we are throwing the bones and reading the tea leaves on a topic that we have been remiss to not cover. We have covered a lot of Batman... A lot of Batman. Matter of fact, I think that Batman manages to infiltrate every show that we do, probably usually in a hobo outfit. And
or celebrating Fourth Meal.
Fourth Meal. Oh, Fourth Meal's going to come up tonight. Don't you worry. Chalupas.
Sort of like a bat hobbit at that point. Second breakfast.
Second. What about second Alfred? What about second breakfast, Alfred?
Bilbo with throat cancer.
That's right. But Cole, what are we going to talk about tonight in terms of Batman?
Batman? Well, tonight we're going to talk about the nature of the kind of hand-in-glove influence that Batman and the comics has had on entertainment media, and then how the reverse has become true as well. And I really feel like our jumping off point, the most significant jumping off point, is the Batman 66 to 68 television series, because that more than anything brought Batman to the fore.
Oh, for sure. And I
mean, the Batman had been around, but
for a show that only ran, what was it, Michael, three seasons, even though
Cole
and I can only focus on one particular season.
That's right. I'm very laser focused on
There's
67.
So much that has been written and so much that has been said on this show that it's almost the Seinfeld of superhero shows after a fashion. Like there's so much, invoking the name, just starting as a jumping off point on the TV show, invoking the name of the issue, which Cole so eloquently threw together like he does all the time, I'm imagining, just as an afterthought of brilliance that he always does. There were 352 instances in three seasons of Robin saying holy something or another. That's a lot.
Yes.
That's a lot of... That's how many per episode is that? If we were doing the math, I would like to know. But
that math is hard.
What? Okay.
Well,
so,
the incredible number of episodes they had, period, in 3 years, because for the first 2 years it was shown twice a week. You had part one, and then on Wednesday, and then part two on Thursday. The cliffhanger in between. So there's just a lot of episodes packed in those 3 years.
Yeah, that's true. It didn't dawn on me.
Yeah, it's one of those things you're kind of aware of, but then, you know, if you're like myself, you caught this in syndication, not always in order. So you might get part one of a Riddler episode, and you get the other half of Shame. You're like, whoa, what the hell? It's like, how am I going to know if he gets out of the clam?
So what? Was the show
one of the greatest special effects of the show? Was the Bad Eddie clam? There's no doubt.
That's one of my favorites.
Was this show popular at the time? Keep in mind, I'm young at 40.
He's a damn kid.
I'm young at 40. Like, so I know that
at the time when it first came out, there were three B's that defined the 60s, and it was Bond, Beatles, and Batman. It was absolutely unbelievably huge.
That's awesome.
Well, I seem to remember hearing or reading somewhere, in fact, that the cameo appearances, the window opening cameos, and that sort of awkward leaning out of a window at the worst possible angle, once you righted the image, everybody was clamoring. If you couldn't get a spot as a bad guy, you weren't anybody if you didn't poke your head out the window.
And the people who poked their head out the window, you had Johnny Carson and Jerry Lewis and just any star wanted to be on that show, and there was a list of them that never got to be because the show only lasted three seasons.
Oh, I didn't realize there were people waiting in the wings or in the windows, as it were.
Because of film commitments and stuff, they couldn't do it here, but they really wanted to. Frank Sinatra was scheduled to be a villain at one point in time. Mm-hmm. The show was just unbelievably popular and then disappeared just as quickly.
Wow, that's pretty remarkable. I also know that, for example, one of my favorites is Werner Klemperer as Klink, mm-hmm. apparently on the lam from Nuremberg or something. I'm not sure.
Yeah.
Edward G. Robinson was one of the people.
And Michael Rennie and Joan Collins and just the list of names of people who were stars on that show is just amazing.
So
people who didn't normally do TV also.
And going through multiple Catwomen and Mr. Freezes and even two Riddlers also very much sets that apart.
Well, this came during a time period where the variety show was, if not king, close to king. And this plays directly into that mythology where everybody...
Sort of a viceroy.
Small principality of NBC was owned by the variety show. But where not only did you, like you said, you had this brilliant cast of villains, not to mention the revolving cast of, of characters, including, Burt Ward and I forget the name of the actor who played Alfred, that basically revived. You'll talk about something that was revived from the 66 Batman. Alfred was dead. They killed Alfred in the comic books and brought him back because of the portrayal in Batman 66. That's power right there, ladies and gentlemen. And that might be the first instance we've seen of something like that happening, only later to be, mimicked or revisited with what we look at when we see things like, which we'll talk about later, Harlequin making the jump from the animated book to being arguably the most popular Bat character, which I might have thrown up in my mouth a little bit, but arguably the most popular Bat character in the world. She just took over. Michael, are you familiar with, like, the Bat Month, where this month is... Or I guess last month was Bat Month?
Every month is Bat Month to me, so I haven't noticed.
For you, it was just September.
It's right.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned Harley Quinn jumping from the animated series to the comics and becoming this huge character and now in films and everything else. Poison Ivy was developed for the 66 series.
What?
Never got around to shooting. What? It would have been an episode in the fourth season, but that's where it was developed before because they wanted another hot femme fatale like Catwoman to put in the series, and Poison Ivy was developed for that, then picked up in the comic books afterwards.
Did not know
that. Is fascinating. So she didn't have the benefit of ever having her pre-comic debut.
In fact, all of the villains, the big villains, the Joker, the Riddler, the Penguin, Catwoman, had virtually disappeared from the comic book for years because of the comic code coming on out. And Catwoman was too sexy to be put in the book, and some of these people were just too psychopathic, and they wouldn't put them in. When the show started, they went back to those original characters, put them in, and then they all came back to the comic book. The Joker had stayed through the comic book, but he had changed. He wasn't as dangerous and murderous anymore. He was just kind of a prankster for those years in between. And it was the show that brought all those villains back.
That's insane.
That is amazing. Really cool. So that, I mean, that is part and parcel, and little wonder it seemed an ideal fit to start with the 60s Batman as our jumping off point, because it had an even greater influence back to the comic than I ever realized.
Pretty huge. And any ad for a Comic-Con you see, or any article about comics or comic book characters, you will see pow, bam, zap, big balloons with spiky stuff. And that all comes from the series. And it's still to this day, that is what is associated with comic books, is those pow, bam, wham images.
The pop art angle that they worked. Also,
yeah.
What always struck me about the show that I always thought was interesting as a student...
It was also onomatopoetry in motion.
was the as a student of the visual arts, which, you know, that's kind of what I went to school for, was the Technicolor, the brighter than life colors in the show, and the way you compared those to the comic book, they almost mimicked each other. Where a lot of the stuff, like if you watched the Hawaii Five-0s or the, you know, they weren't the same. I don't know what they did, and or if they did anything, or if I'm making an illogical leap to think this, but, you know, the colors were on the show. I don't know whether they cranked up the vibrancy to make it more comic book like, but it definitely side by side compares. I don't know if it does, but.
It's that color palette they were using to give it that bright comic book feel, because comic books at the time were a much simpler printing process than what they use now, and there were only so many colors available to them, and using the bright colors made the pages pop. And the art direction for 66 copied that right on off. There's so much influence that it had back and forth. A lot of people blame the 66 series for making the comics more comic.
yeah.
But that really isn't true, because when the comic code came on in, Batman, all of a sudden you saw this smiling Batman. I can't remember the artist. But and he quit fighting those villains that he'd had before, and there were a lot of space aliens, and it was, I think, him as Scoutmaster Batman through that time. And that had been going on, and we'd lost the Dark One, which, you know, originally where Batman was throwing people off roofs and stuff like that.
Oh,
that
yeah,
had disappeared
just,
from the comics already.
Savaging his enemies.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I think that's an interesting point to bring up, because outside of the context of the comics prior to the series, it's easy to point at the series and say, oh, it was so goofy that just leached into the comic. But the problem was, as you say, the comic was already forced to be goofy and you know, lighthearted and fun, because the Comics Code Authority wouldn't allow for a, you know, Batman to go around happily killing bad guys who deserved it, in his point of view.
And there probably, you know, wasn't any danger of the Batman book being canceled in 66, but he sold about half as much as Superman at the time, and certainly down from like his peak in the 40s after the series came out. Batman was outselling Superman, probably up until you get the Superman movie with Christopher Reeve.
Good night.
Because
yes.
It had such a huge influence on, you know, people going to comics. As a kid, I'm like 7 years old when the series premiered, and that started me reading my very first comic book. Because I was so in love with this series that yeah. I wanted everything Batman I could get my hands on.
And that's exactly the kind of story we love to hear when we have guests on the show, is these kind of catalyst things are always fun to hear about.
Well, and it's interesting that you would say that, because there's a there was an article, again, Grant Morrison was talking about why people love the 60s Batman, unless you're an adolescent boy. Like, that's the only time you don't love it. You know, he basically said the 60s Batman works because when you're a kid, you take it really seriously, and when you're an adult, you think it's pretty funny. But when you're an adolescent, you're getting into the idea that Batman is something cool and mysterious and a reflection of your own darker moods. And then you really hate the Adam West stuff because the adolescent concept of Batman is a tortured, angst-ridden loner. But the older you get, the funnier you get. It gets. So the younger you are, the more serious you take it. The older you get, funnier it gets. But there's a middle period where you're like, Batman should sit alone in his room in front of his fireplace with Ace and not talk to anybody, and then at midnight put on his suit and go out and punch Kite Man in the face 5 times and then come back. Why is he doing this? Why is there a zip and a pow? What's this? And then all of a sudden you're like, oh, I work 40 hours a week now. I get it.
Oh, right. Yeah. It's like, you know, I was in line at the Taco Bell for not... fourth. Go ahead.
For fourth meal? Yeah, I'm sorry. I had to let you get that in.
And Kite Man was in the way of the drive-thru, so I had to punch him.
Kite Man was working the drive-thru at Taco Bell again. Couldn't get my chalupas. Punch him.
There's a whole mini-series here. But,
it really is.
No, as a kid watching the show, I had no idea it was a comedy. It was completely serious to me. Every episode would end. There was this cliffhanger. I was just distraught and waiting to find out what would happen. And it wasn't until many, many years later that I started watching going, my God, this is the funniest thing I've ever seen. But no, as a kid, it was dead serious. We were invested in this.
Yeah, that's an interesting point, too, is, you know, in that period, in that moment, I remember, you know, watching the syndicated over many, many years, and it took many, many years to work out that there was that kind of connection, you know, the two episodes back to back type of thing, because they weren't always shown, weren't always aired properly. And I remember that, like, one of the local channels had picked it up again, you know, for the 20th time over the last 10 years. And the ad campaign had a line that I will always remember: the Cape Crusaders meet out laughter weekday afternoons. And like, yeah, I guess it is kind of a comedy, isn't it?
There's some funny things every once in a while, but come on.
They do meet out laughter occasionally. And of course, then they would have the scene with Batman. They're going, citizens, citizens. Hi, kids. It's like, one of the best, absolute best lines.
Well, I guess, you know, Goodfellas was kind of funny at parts too, so I'll let this one go.
What, is Batman a clown to amuse you? What makes Batman so funny? No, you said it. You know what you said.
So we know that it was popular. We know what it was, right? Cole, was it on this show or was it on Amazing Comicast that we did the whole breakdown where you guys discovered my my long-lasting hatred of Shelley Winters?
That had to be back in the past days, because
Ma Barker.
Oh yeah, well, it stems from
Shelley Winters carried well into United States of Geekdom.
You've got to understand that this is genetic. This is a blood hatred. This is a feud that has been passed down to me for at least one generation since the Poseidon Adventure, and now I have to carry the burden.
Let the Poseidon Adventure go.
Listen.
It's like a demonic version of the Titanic for you.
When you're 5 or 6 years old and your dad's yelling about Shelley Winters getting stuck in a porthole and that's the reason that the ship sunk, that sticks with you.
That should have been the reason the ship stayed upright.
That stays with you forever. You never leave. That never leaves you. So when she shows up on Batman, you're like, oh, so maybe this is the one where he shoots somebody. Please.
Could it finally be?
This is the one where he finally loses it. He's one bad day away from shooting Shelley Winters. That's what I want to see.
Just one bad day.
That's right. Well, I have to point out that the Shelley Winters hatred was so legendary that it carried into United States of Geekdom. And the very first post I did on that website with United States of Geekdom, the movie, the very first incarnation, Andy Serkis did the motion capture for Shelley Winters.
That's true.
For CG Shelley Winters to menace you.
She had since passed, right? I think. Oh
yeah,
long
since, passed.
Yeah. So how does this? I'm really interested in and really want to know what your guys' take in on how the show has influenced what everything that came after it. And I don't want to, you know, sit down and unroll the scrolls or anything like that, but I was amazed when I was thinking about it, and I did a little research this week. Every store that I went into that wasn't, you know, specifically that I had a question as to whether they would have some Batman merchandise in there, you know, absolutely had Batman merchandise in it. You can go anywhere, get Batman, and I'm not just talking your Targets or your Walmarts or your Kohl's or, you know, your Macy's. I'm not even just talking about your Hot Topics or your Spencer Gifts or your FYEs. Like, every store has, you can find something Batman related. Batman has become the Rosetta Stone of comic books, much more so, I think, than any other comic book character that we can see, even more than a Superman or a Spider-Man, even with the Marvel movies where, you know, everybody knows who Captain America is. I think like children are now born with the ability to use iPads somehow. Like, I think children are born knowing the origin story of Batman and how to use iPads now. I don't know how it happens, but they just know. How did it influence not only the movies and the TV shows, but the zeitgeist of everything around us? You know, obviously it's there, and I think you can point directly to Batman 66 and say, this is when it started.
Well, I think the merchandising definitely starts at that point. The 66 show came out, and all of a sudden it was so huge that the t-shirts and the toys and the everything you could imagine just started showing up and flooding in the stores. And comic books was brand new to this and sold the rights cheap, so there was tons of stuff out there, and that certainly led to that, to where marketing campaigns for stuff to sell toys probably didn't hit that peak again until 77 when Star Wars came out.
That's a good point, because, I mean, certainly the Superman television series, which predates by a great number of years, brought Superman so much into the spotlight, and there were Superman like everything. But in so many ways, I think that 66 is the turning point for Batman, where Batman not only begins to surpass in comic book sales, but even begins to surpass Superman as, for lack of a better term, America's superhero. He's sort of the go-to superhero for everybody. There's a certain camp that will always be the Superman people. Batman seems to be the universal hero, the one that everybody will have a decal on the back of their truck, or a t-shirt, or a tattoo, or a coffee mug, or something. There's always something Batman.
Even
so,
friends of mine who are like huge Marvel fans, they much prefer Marvel to DC, except Batman. he's still the coolest. So,
well, when you can prefer when you can prefer Marvel, unless you can prefer Batman, in which case you should always prefer Batman.
But the show brought comic books to the fore to a national audience. It's not just kids, because everyone's watching this show, and really changed the image. Now, the Superman TV show had done that, and I'd watched that as a kid also, but never sought out Superman comic books. It wasn't until this Batman show that I went, I want more of this guy. And I know it for me as a kid, I could be Batman. It was too late for me to be born on Krypton. My odds of getting bit by a radioactive spider just weren't really good. I didn't see someone coming down and handing me a Green Lantern ring, but all I had to do was be really smart and really rich, and I could be Batman.
Don't crush my dreams about that Green Lantern ring, please. Don't do it. I'm still waiting.
It's still possible, and your letter from Hogwarts is just lost in the now, so don't worry.
Yeah.
I want a letter to
Sky Knightley.
I do.
Sir.
I do. I just scream into the night, into the empty, empty cold skies. Just wait. And I want that letter from Hogwarts just so I can go TP the place. Just so I know where it is. No, but that's a really valid point. And this show does not get political unless we're specifically getting political. But I think that the character of Bruce Wayne, I think the character of Batman, of Bruce Wayne, is more relevant than ever right now. Because, you know, with it, it's money and it's an average guy, right? I mean, he average in the DC universe, let's just say that, with a lot of money, not a lot of time on his hands, but somehow manages to do good with himself and make good for humanity, which I think is very resonant. And I think it's always been very resonant, right? Like especially since the 60s, when we start getting into the 70s and the 80s, when we start talking about, you know, Reaganomics, I don't want to get too far into this, but I just think it resonates really well. Is there a time and a place? This is off topic, but is there a time and a place for the Bruce Wayne comic book? That's something I've always wanted.
Him sitting behind a desk writing checks to charities.
Well, I think more like the boardroom scandal style West Wing-ish Aaron Sorkin Batman book. You know what I mean? Like Lucius Fox, Bruce Wayne, taking on LexCorp and taking on, you know, whoever else, Roxxon Oil, even though I don't believe that that's, I believe they think it's Marvel. Yeah, but he'll do it. He'll do it, yeah.
He has that kind of reach.
But yeah, I just always, that I think it resonates really well.
Well, I think the Lex Luthor as president is resonating extremely well these days.
Well said.
So that could definitely work out.
Should Bruce run against Lex for president? Could we have President Batman? Could he pull that off?
Ooh, that would be interesting. Hiding a bat cave underneath the White House.
Right?
And slipping the Secret Service agent so he could go out and fight crime.
Oh, I want to see it.
He could just do like in the 60s television series and have Alfred dress up as him.
Yes. And okay. It was indetectable. You couldn't tell the difference between the two of them.
No, were completely indistinguishable. And it was just the perfect approach. But no, and one of the things you brought up was the approachability to adults and children of the 60s series. And that's an important point as well, because much like, say, the Muppet Show or old Warner cartoons, when you go back and revisit a lot of these things as an adult, you see how wonderfully layered a lot of these things become. Back when,
how much went over your head as a kid?
Oh, exactly. I remember watching as an adult one of the episodes where Joker was subverting the high school kids, I believe, and he had some young chick in his pocket doing his bidding, and she phones him at the headquarters and says, "How do you stop a dog barking in July?" And then Joker gleefully is like, "Countersign, shoot him in June." And I fell out of my chair. That was the funniest. It was so unexpected. It was the, you know, why did the monkey fall out of the tree dynamic. It was dead.
And it was, go back to the, this was an evil Joker.
Yeah.
He was campy, certainly, but he was also murderous and quite insane, and would talk about shooting an animal. And
exactly, yeah, that's quite literally.
And Gorshin's Riddler was just horrifying. It's like, this guy's crazy. You have no idea what this guy's going to do next.
Well, then, of course, the rivalry between the villains in the movie as well.
Yes.
Or they have this very uncomfortable alliance. That was even more tenuous than the League of Nations or whatever it was. They turned into so much Kool-Aid.
What was the Tang, the League of Tang Nations? What was the Well, Cole and I had the esteemed honor of going to see the Batman 66 movie at the Alamo Drafthouse even though we didn't go together, I believe, if I'm not mistaken, Cole.
That sounds about right, yes.
You guys were like 80 rows in front of us.
Yeah.
Just shockingly, Cole and I ended up going to see Batman 66 at the same time in the same place and weren't aware that I think we were going to the same time in the same place. But there were still moments. I've seen it probably 50 times, you know, because whatever UHF channel had it, they would run it every single Saturday. But going and seeing it, there were still moments in the movie that made me laugh out loud, no matter how many times you see it. The riddle of...
Oh, absolutely.
The Robin riddle. Was it, what has... what weighs so many ounces...
Oh, and yes, a sparrow with a machine gun.
A sparrow with a machine gun. I was in the back of the Alamo Draft House laughing.
Of course, a sparrow with a machine gun. What other answer could there have been?
And how can you... The thing about it is, having seen it on television repeatedly, it was wonderful to see the full cut and the very subtle, actually glaring in its subtlety, the dream of world peace with Miss Kitka.
Yes.
Yes.
And her diddling away her Morse code while Bruce very orgasmically brings this dream to its climax.
Yeah. Yes.
And that.
Now, while you guys were there watching that, there was an empty seat in that theater.
Oh, no.
I owned that ticket.
No,
but unfortunately something came up at work and I couldn't make it that night. But yes, there was an empty seat there that belonged to me. But I did see it on the big screen when I was probably 7 or 8, whatever I was when it came out. Because yep, went to the movies and saw it. Absolutely, because it was our first time to see the Bat Cycle, the Bat Boat, and the Bat Helicopter.
Yes, and they got
those premiered in the movie.
They got some Hollywood money behind them and went nuts. So movie budget.
I think that, though, I think we'd be remiss if we didn't mention how, in a lot of ways subtly and in some ways overtly, counterculture and subversive the TV show and the movie was to the time period. You know, there were a lot of things that happened in the TV show and the movie that were... I don't want to say I'm not gonna call them leftist, but progressive in ways that I don't know if you were getting necessarily on TV show, masked in that Star Trek-ian way of sci-fi and comic books love to do, you know, where when you watch them, you know, again with more critical eye, you're like, oh, we're getting away with that, are we? Yeah,
well,
so
actually, you had the mayor of Gotham, Mayor Linseed. Who was a direct parody of Mayor Lindsay, who was the mayor of New York at the time. There was a lot of little undercurrents of politics going on in there.
So you had hippies and stuff like that. Oh, yeah. Much like in Star Trek as well. You had your hippie subculture.
Yeah, your space hippies. You had Gotham hippies also. Louis the Lilac.
Yeah.
And then that explains why Gotham was immediately across the bay or whatever from New Guernsey.
Yes. Yeah.
was New Guernsey. Oh, good night. So moving forward a little bit, speaking of film and the influence, you have the animated series comes along and does exactly what the original live action series did, and that's get a Hollywood, you know, a theatrical movie.
Well, at this point, seeing as many cartoons as I've seen, even as an adult, right? Because I'm just a man baby anyway. I don't know if there's ever been a better superhero cartoon than Batman the Animated Series. It was one of the truest depictions of Batman. Conroy and Hamill just set the tone for the next 25 years worth of Batman. You can't do a Batman without invoking some Conroy, or a Joker without invoking some Hamill.
We skipped over one because the series doesn't show up until after Tim Burton's Michael Keaton Batman.
Oh, that's so true. And in Keaton's Batman, or in Burton's Batman, rather, you also have this... One of the things I thought was very clever, I think some people miss, is the opening to Burton's Batman, which is a feint where you think for a minute you're seeing kind of a retelling of the Batman origin that children are born yes. with. And then you realize that, no, this is contemporary Gotham, and this is the guy who's about to get a nut shot from a bat boot a little later on.
Well,
who are you?
Fourth meal. I'm fourth meal. How much do you weigh? Well, I did have fourth meal. You said.
Oh, yeah. Let me crank this up a bit, because those chalupas will really right. put on the pound.
To get some of the cinnamon twists.
Yeah,
I remember watching that animated series when it first showed up and going, oh, they're doing a cartoon, let's see. And then watching that first episode and going, my God, this is so much darker than I was expecting. And going, this is so much better than I was expecting, because I was expecting Super Friends to show back up again. And, oh, you know, yeah. Aquaman would be dropping in on a regular basis to talk to fish.
Somebody call Casey Kasem.
Yeah, exactly. That's what I was expecting, and then all of a sudden this showed up, and it was like, yeah, this is really cool.
Which you wouldn't believe how many people I tell Casey Kasem voiced Robin in, I think, every cartoon incarnation prior to the animated series, on Scooby-Doo, on the Batman and Robin show, on Super Friends, and they're like completely freaking out that they didn't notice, solely because Robin never said, well, that's one of Riddler's top 40 riddles.
This is a long-distance dedication from the Penguin. No, they never happened. But so much came out of the show. They fleshed out so much of the Bat universe on this show that then it's almost like a universal translator where they would things like Harley Quinn originated in Bruce Timm, you know, it originated there and then made its way into the mainstream to where we know it today. If you've ever been to a convention, you've seen Harley Quinn. But
in the last 15 or 20 years, you've probably seen what I would wager to say 40 different incarnations of Harley Quinn.
And they're still coming.
Yeah, to the point where I think in the comics, it's almost like an imperative where I've forgotten the producer who left the Star Wars saga after Empire because he felt that Lucas was pandering too much to the toy companies. It's almost like DC is pandering heavily to cosplayers by making it easier and easier to be Harley Quinn.
Well, there's enough Harley Quinns out there that you might one day be hosting a game show and call somebody by the wrong name because they're wearing a full Harley Quinn costume and get in trouble for the rest of your life. Oh, no, that was just me. like full-blown Harley Quinn.
I hear a story somewhere in there, but...
It was a full-blown Harley Quinn costume, like head-to-toe pajama Harley Quinn costume with hood up. And face makeup.
I know exactly, yeah.
And I called the person by the wrong name because there were two people wearing the exact same costume, and I didn't know who was who. And I got in a lot of trouble for that, and I still haven't lived it down. But you take things, concepts from the comic books up to this point, and you throw them into this culture grinder that is the Batman the Animated Series, right? And then spit them out the other side, and they become culturally palatable to everyone versus, you know, it's almost like Exhibits Pimp Your Comic Book Character, where you take Bane and you're like, okay, it's Bane, he broke Batman's back. The only people that really know that are comic book fans. You know, like,
true.
At that point, you throw him into Batman the Animated Series, he comes out the other side, the super popular character with great public renown at that point. The one that always gets me, the coolest one is, was it the Gray Ghost? Is that?
I think that's right. Yes.
Right? Yeah. Cause that was a reference in DC Comics prior to the animated series. They throw it in the animated series and it comes out the other side, starts getting action figures and, you know, the whole nine yards. And I was like, this is a really cool concept. Like, that's a really cool idea. They brought so much to the public through the animated series and were so true to the character and what had come before that I think you want to talk about bringing a lot of fans on board to the Batman comic books. I'm not sure which did more, the 66 show or the animated series.
I think you're right there, because what you also get to this point where there's a greater synergy between the two, where in some ways, obviously, like with the aforementioned Poison Ivy, which, you know, I was clueless on this, you know, that character comes from what would have been. And then, you know, by the animated series, things are going back and forth between the two. There's a shared universe that begins to develop that I think is largely unprecedented.
At that point in time, they're influencing each other fantastically, the comics and the animated series. And, you know, and you can't underestimate the Burton film for really getting this started, because I don't think you would have seen Batman the Animated Series if the Burton film hadn't been such a huge blockbuster hit.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think had we had, say, the Batman and Robin and Batman Forever version first, we may never have seen such a resurgence in interest in the character.
No, you probably would have gotten one, maybe two movies, and it would have been over.
Yeah.
But it just so it seems like, and I don't know whether they made a, you know, a deal with the devil, or they just had some, this is the one thing that Warner Brothers, when it comes, or you know, DC and then Warner Brothers as in terms of the comic book media that they're putting out there, it seems like Batman, the big tentpole Batman stuff, right? Your 66, your Tim Burton, your animated series, your Christian Bale. It seems like they hit, you know, they struck perfectly at the right time and place to not only continue a culture's love of their character, but also push it that far forward to give it a little more momentum up to the next iteration, then a little more momentum up to the next iteration. I don't know if we have anything right now that's going to be that next thing. I'm not sure yet. I'm on the fence about what's coming.
Personally, as someone who became quite enamored of the catalyst of, you know, one of the big catalysts of the next big thing, what's going to be the next big thing? Everybody's looking for the next big thing, being Star Wars. I think what's wonderful about the next big thing, it's like the Mandarin and Iron Man. You never see it coming.
No, it's no one saw Star Wars coming. Which is how Lucas was able to make such ungodly amounts of money off of it. Well, they never would have let him have all that toy licensing and stuff if they had a clue.
Oh, if they had a, yeah. If, now nobody's going to get that deal ever again.
And, you know, and the Burton Batman film, I remember when they announced Michael Keaton. At the time, we were kind of in a backlash about the 66. You couldn't have it on video, so no one was really being able to watch the whole thing and see how incredible it really was. And there was a backlash that, no, I don't want. And then they announced Michael Keaton. It's like, oh, no, they're going to remake 66.
Oh,
I want Dark Knight Batman. I want, you know,
well, you had
the gritty stuff.
As director. The combination of Burton's director and Keaton.
Well, his
star.
Only big credit before that was Pee-wee's Big Adventure.
Right.
Yes.
And
so
Beetlejuice. And so you're going, no, this is going to be a silly Batman. Yeah.
It was going to be a farce. And this is like pre-internet. So we were capable of going nuts and gnashing our teeth on a national level, even without benefit of the internet. That's what's really frightening.
It was more of a Pony
comic
Express.
Book stores. Yeah, anyone you could find that you would listen to you rant, you did.
Or even if they wouldn't.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, that's why I got into podcasting.
You were doing it on an 8-track in your basement.
They wouldn't listen. So, yes, absolutely. And, you know, what's fascinating is that ultimately, within Burton's own personal vision, you still find elements. The influences are there. And there's some wonderful little touches in there as well, because he basically eschews Joe Chill so that within the context of the narrative, you have a greater connection between Bruce Wayne and his parents' killer. But
making the Joker his parents' killer was definitely a tie it together tighter sort of move. It didn't thrill some of us, but we still couldn't not love the movie. So.
Exactly. And one of the things I think is was really kind of clever is you get the flashback with young Napier, with young Jack, back when he was a petty...
Wait, Jack Palance was the Joker?
No.
Isn't that what you just did? Oh,
no,
I'm sorry.
Jack, don't forget your lucky deck.
That was Palance, yeah.
Pass me my inhaler.
I forgot that Palance was in that movie until you just did that. I thought you were doing a bad Nicholson and not a good Palance. Sorry, my bad.
Funny thing is, my bad Nicholson has been credited as being a great Jack Palance, and I never realized that I was doing Jack Palance.
Every great impression starts with 30 bad ones, so good job, man.
That's right. But what's neat there is there's the scene where, you know, after you get the flashback, you see the actor playing the young Jack Napier. When Alfred brings Bruce the file, there is this glaring, gigantic 8x10 headshot mugshot of the guy, obscured by some sort of pamphlet or something, that's so painfully obvious to the audience. And Bruce is going, flipping through the, I don't know what the hell that picture is. I got to see what, I got to read about his aptitudes and stuff. And, you know, to me, that was always this wonderful little irony that I think a lot of people missed in the context of the show the production is they actually give you this little, you know, if he'd only looked.
Yeah. So obsessed.
He had to wait to make the connection.
Well, and I think there's a part of Batman since we're starting to look at wrapping this show up that most people have forgotten or don't get unless you're a real, I guess, Batman head, I guess, a Batmaniac. Is that what we're called? I don't know. And that's the idea.
Batmaniac.
on the floor. Bat-watusi. is that there the thing that's so endearing about a good Batman story, and whether it be Batman 66, whether it be Batman 89, whether it be the animated series, and honestly, some of the Christian Bale stuff. And some of the Affleck stuff we've seen so far, Batman is at his most connected with you as an audience member, especially in the comics and in those particular instances, because he, for all of his grousing and for all of his I am the Knight and for all of his gravelly voice and for all of his money and gadgets.
And fourth meal.
There are periods where you actually get to see him enjoying being Batman.
That's so true.
And that's what really draws an audience in. It's very prevalent in the 66. It's absolutely there in the 89. It comes up quite a bit in the animated. We get to see it a little bit in the later, like a little bit. The Christian Bale movies are pretty damn dark, but it's in there a little bit. And the Affleck stuff, that's the smilingest Batman I think I've seen since 66 is Ben Affleck's Batman. Like when they're showing the previews for the Justice League movie and he's all happy and smiley. Like I'm like, okay, he's just enjoying his job of beating up parademons. It's not, he's a happy Batman. He's just, you know, but I think that translates well. You know, I think that's when he's at his most open and vulnerable to an audience. It happens a lot in the comics. If you read the comics, there's always the aside where he's kind of smiling off to himself in the rafters in the watchtower. But I wanted to make
mention
of that.
There's also the humanizing quality of Alfred also.
Yes.
All the way through is that he's kind of you. Good. hold on. Back up just a little bit here.
Yeah. If I can interject about... you know, excessive fisticuffs. No, you can't.
What time did you get in last night, Batman? 4 in the morning. Well, you have a board meeting at 8. So here's 8 pounds of solid brick Motrin, and
this is like a black tar ibuprofen or something.
And a vat of Icy Hot for you to climb through on your way out the door.
Just slide on in.
Yeah, you're right. We are all exhausted. We're all Alfred. At a point, we're all exhausted with Batman. You know, we're exhausted with this lifestyle and what's expected of us to be fans of Batman. But we keep coming back to it because it means so much to us that we have a hero that can be fatigued. We have a hero that can be hurt. We have a hero whose emotions can be played upon. You know, you don't have to threaten to nuke the entire world to get you to fly around the world backwards and turn back time if you're Batman. You know, it's much easier to move the heartstrings and the emotions when you're a character like Batman.
The wheels off the Batmobile and you could become Robin.
Yeah, and then we're going to dial a 1-800 number and have you killed.
Well, you know, the Batmobile lost a wheel.
Is that how
Robin laid an egg?
Oh my God. So is there anything current that we want to talk about? Like where's this all led us?
I do want to touch on the influence of the Burton Batman from the production design standpoint, and that is the design of Gotham City, the whacked out Gotham, from the twisted mind of the late Anton First, who apparently went nuts after that and killed himself.
Damn.
So,
not sure if they're directly related, but yeah.
Yeah, I was nuts already anyway, just more nuts. But that actually began to have an influence within a few years on the look of Gotham in the comics, to the point where there was a deliberate move on DC's part to acknowledge the Anton First Gotham in a storyline called Destroyer. And they made a big deal about that.
The production value on that was just so incredible, and Gotham was a character of its own with these huge statues and gargoyles and gothic look to the whole city that was just incredible. And you've got a whole Batman gothic series that I think you could put pretty much squarely on the shoulders of Anton First.
Oh, yes. And this highly industrialized, he gives you this ugly city that somehow still has a lot of heart. It, you know, you become endearing. It has this endearing quality despite, you know, looking like just a whole lot of machinery.
I don't know if you ever played the game DC Universe Online, Well, if you remember, Gotham was always night, and Metropolis was always day.
Yeah. Yep.
Yeah, it was never day in Gotham, and it was always daytime in Metropolis, which was just such a great dichotomy between the two fandoms. It's like, yes, this is bright and cheery in Metropolis, and Gotham is a hellhole.
Well, and also that's a good point, because that's one thing I think Zack Snyder in the production design of Batman v Superman missed, because fanboys have wanted a world's finest movie. We were repeatedly promised a world's finest movie, and that very dichotomy is lost when you can stand on the shore of Gotham Bay and look over and, oh, looky, there's the Daily Planet building.
Right.
And the two cities are practically identical, and both of them are grim. And there's no, you know, and both Batman and Superman are grim. There's no dichotomy. You don't have the day and night. It's true. All just sort of a really muggy, nasty afternoon. It's real rainy, so, you know, good thing we bought all those coloring books, because it's going to be one of those afternoons.
But, Cole, you invoked
something.
And
we bought fourth meal.
Yeah, there's no fourth meal in Metropolis. Yeah. That's what separates them. They're all farm to table.
Or worse yet, snout the tail type of places.
I mean,
God.
I mean, Gotham is just full of taco trucks.
Yeah.
Gotham is full of taco trucks. You can get tacos day or night. And you invoked something about 5 minutes ago that I kicked the wheels going about something that I wanted to remember to talk about, and that was the show Gotham. Michael, how do you feel about Gotham?
I really like it.
Thank you. I enjoy
it a lot.
Good. It's the only fantastic one.
It's a fantastic what-if story.
Well, I think...
And it's like, you don't. It doesn't fit into the continuity of the comics, the movies, anything else. It's its own thing, and enjoy it for what it is.
Well, what they
did... What about the Beat Boy skeletons? They're part of it.
They're part of it. I can't wait for that animated show, by the way, Cole. We might have to do a special episode on David S. Pumpkins, the animated show. It focuses on the we broke Michael a little bit.
We can get derailed so easily here, Michael.
It brought in Gordon as a main Batman supporting cast member at the same level as an Alfred, which every iteration of Batman has a Gordon, and Gordon is highly important to the Batman universe. The thing that Gotham figured out, and I don't know when, but I can almost pinpoint it. I would love to have been in the writer's room when they were trying to make a real serious, NYPD Blue show in the first season. And then at some point halfway through the second season, they looked at their script and just wadded it up and threw it in the trash and said, all right, let's just crack open Arkham and let everybody out and get crazy with this thing. All the wheels are coming off. We're going to bring every villain in. We're going to make it super nuts. Hugo Strange is going to show up. He's going to make Monster Men. It's going to be fantastic. And that's when the show got really good. That's when the show, for me.
That's the point where you're like, you want to get nuts? We're going to get nuts.
Yeah. They went full Burton at that point.
And we have to touch on the remake of the 66 show in cartoon form with Adam West and Burt Ward voices.
Yes. And
which is absolutely wonderful. It's so good because you have Adam West voicing some of the lines from Tim Burton, lines from the Dark Knight comic book when he's under the influence of some drug and turns him evil. And he does the let's get nuts line, and he does the,
wonderful.
They may walk with a limp, but they'll live. And they use all of that stuff. And at one point in time, he gets hit in the head. He's looking at Catwoman, and she splits in three. And she is obviously the three Catwomen from the series.
That's fantastic.
And he's
so
like, he's shaking his head as he looks at this, and it's absolutely wonderful.
That's
it nods
amazing
to everything that came after it. If you haven't seen it, do yourself a favor and find it.
I need to seek that out because that sounds absolutely brilliant. And another thing, speaking of nods, and this is another observation I made, that sometimes people are like, is the one thing the Batman v Superman, in my opinion, did right. There are very subtle nods to every incarnation of Batman.
Yes.
And it's a wonderful thing to discover. I'm almost willing to choke it down again just to relive that. But it is a neat little thing where you've got these nods to something that came before.
The two fans of Gotham in the world, I am a fan of Batman versus Superman. I love the movie. I own it. I've watched it repeated times. There are layers all over that thing, and I really enjoy it. But
I
want to
have another podcast with Michael about this. I want to start it now. We're going to have a whole podcast because I want to do a podcast where Michael sells me on Batman v Superman because I really want to enjoy it more than I did, and I've watched it three times trying to, and every time I enjoy it a little more. So I think that there's just
I think it does get better with repeated viewing. Said he's a director's cut is much better than the theatrical release. And there actually, I'll give a nod out to my friend Lisa. She has a podcast called I Love That Movie, which is where you only talk positively about movies you care for. I did an episode.
That's great.
Of Batman versus Superman.
That goes against everything we stand for here at the JCU, but that's great. That's awesome. No, I'm kidding.
Well, that's the whole purpose of her podcast is she goes, so many of them are so negative where they just tear things apart.
Oh, that's yeah.
So cool. Wanted just people talking about movies they love. And that's the entire thing is so a guest comes on and talks about a movie that they just absolutely love and talks about why they love it.
If she ever wants to do Red Dawn,
a podcast.
Sorry, Cole.
Yeah, I would enjoy guesting on a show like that because there are movies that I can just gush about ad nauseum.
One thing,
I'll make sure and add you to the Facebook group.
Very
good.
As we walk out of the Gotham Wayne Manor or drive through the holographic wall or the weird do not enter sign, which apparently fools everybody into not coming into the Batcave if you're in the in the 60s Batman. There's one thing I did want to touch on before we leave, and that was the Batman, the original Batman TV series, and how socially aware and progressive it was. Because at one point, they had Batgirl do a PSA about equal pay.
Yes. That was actually a few years after the series, and you have Yvonne Craig, and you have Burt Ward, and you have someone else standing in for Adam West.
Really? I didn't know that.
Yeah. Okay. If you listen, it's not his voice. and he speaks very little in it. Because, Adam ended up going, no, if you want me to put the suit on, I want a lot of money for it. So he wasn't interested in doing it.
Yeah, like, this is a PSA. We don't own a lot of money.
Yes.
And in the meantime...
Yeah, it's a great one. And Batgirl, again, is one that comics influencing the show influencing comics. They'd gotten rid of Batwoman. Batgirl hadn't existed. Someone saw a drawing at the DC offices that someone had done up, and that is basically what became Batgirl in the series and then in the comics.
That's amazing. That's awesome. That's really, really cool.
Because
they wanted to add a femme fatale sort of, or, you know, more feminine thing to it to get more viewers, because they were starting to lose it after the second season. And so, again, the show spawned off something that would become huge.
See, and again, as predicted or as mentioned at the top of the show, more so we're proving how blessed we are to have you as a guest on the show, because you're bringing so much to the table that we were unaware of.
Michael, do you have anything that you would like to plug on the way out? Is there anywhere people can find you, anything that you're doing, anything you want people to be aware of?
Well, actually, yes, I will. This Sunday at the Alamo in Richardson will be the Texas premiere of The Demon with the Atomic Brain.
What?
This is my friend Christopher R. Mim. He makes 50s drive-in movies. He's making brand new 50s drive-in movies, and this one will be premiering at the Alamo. Yes, Cole has been to many of them.
And they're just, it's so much fun because they have the feel of both the modern film and this delightful sense of just cheesy drive-in movies from the 50s.
That's fantastic.
He shoots them digitally. He will even go in and put real marks into them so that when you're watching, you see the real mark pop up, even though there is no projector to change the reels for.
You're half waiting for the film to burn through at some point.
Oh, exactly. So cool. That is so cool. Like, I love that. I wish I could get that here. I'm jealous. That's all there is to it.
Where is here?
Here is up in the JCU North offices in Middle Ohio.
Ah.
Middle Ohio.
Well,
up here.
Christopher is actually out of Minneapolis.
Oh, okay.
That's where he makes his films. And the world premiere of the film was last night at a theater up in Minneapolis. And then the Texas premiere will be the second time it's ever shown in a theater this coming Sunday.
That's fantastic.
Right here in good old Dallas, Texas.
That's fantastic. Cole, do you have any plugs for us? What do we need to know? Where can we find it? What do you got going on, my man?
Oh, there is so much. I barely have the stick to shake it at all, but you can find us, of course, on the Jedi Cole universe at JediCole.com. You can, I'm not going to promise to tweet anything, but I do occasionally try to tweet on at the Jedi Cole U. I am also an increasingly part of DallasOnAir.com. You can check out on the first and third Sundays of every month from 10:30 to 11:30 a.m. Central, the Rancor Pit Live. Something else I won't promise right away, but we are trying to bring back the pre-recorded Rancor Pit. If you enjoyed that, we miss it as much as you do. Eddie and I have both been so embroiled in other things, including Eddie and I were both offered an extra hour or 2 hours collectively, which we split between the two of us, on the Dallas On Air, where we now each have our own independent shows. Eddie and his wife, Colleen, do Figments on the first Sunday of every month from 9:30 to 10:30 a.m. Central. And on the third
I'll be a
Sunday,
guest.
And yes, indeed, that's true. You've guessed it twice in our many incarnations in many places. And also on the third Sunday of every month preceding the Rancor Pit, 9:30 to 10:30 a.m. Central, is my new show, Isle of Toys, where pretty much if it's toys, I hope to eventually get around to it. If I can find people in the area to come talk up their favorite kinds of toys, I'm all the more for that. This Sunday, this coming Sunday, from the aforementioned 9:30 to 10:30 a.m., Jason the X from SCNS Live will be joining me to talk about GoBots, because that's one of the... Oh, sorry. Transformers. Oh, I spoke.
Guess what? I'm calling in. That's all there is to it.
Oh, yeah.
I'm calling in.
I wish I could get my hands on some GoBots. So if anybody in the Dallas area hears this, drop me a line at... Oh, God, what is it? JCMail@yahoo.com or heykidscomics@gmail.com, better still. And if you can lend me some GoBots for a day, I would really love to just really get his ire up. But we're going to be talking about those robots in disguise, the Transformers, and good night. Already, even though it's months away, preparations are already underway for Games and Theory Department for AllCon 2018.
Buddy.
So yeah. That's going to be my one of my passions for a while now.
Cole is also my bat toy pimp.
Yes, indeed.
He sends me texts with pictures of bat toys he's found. And goes, would you be interested? It's like, yes, you know I would. Just tell me how much it is and I'll send it to PayPal.
I'm going to put this out there right now that something that we need to do as a collective, and Cole, I don't know whether you want to start this or you want, it could be a division. I don't want it to be, I want it to be a closed group, invite only, starting with you, with the royal four of us, Eddie included, where we start a closed group somewhere where we can just, because we all do this. You know, like in some sort of weird conspiracy theory pegboard wall where we're all sending pictures to various each other about toys that we find. We need to start some sort of group, you know, that we can just post like this. I found this. Does anybody want it? Thumbs up, thumbs down. I did hear from Eddie today that he finally broke down and bought the Punisher in the Daredevil Marvel Legends. We got him, Cole. We got him.
He has joined the group.
We broke him. I wondered what would break first. Your mind or your body? We got him. We maned that ass.
Boom! Or your wallet.
That's right, your wallet. As far as Hey Kids Comics goes, HK Comics Show, Instagram, Twitter, really, really big on the Instagrams, really big on the Twitters. Facebook, we're getting up and running again. The whole of the JCU, we have some exciting YouTube announcements coming up around issue 250 that we're going to share with everybody. A lot of cool stuff coming up.
And Isle of Toys also has an Instagram.
It does.
It's A-I-S-L-E.
I'm proud of you, Cole. I'm so proud.
So far, my followers have been greater than my posts.
I'm very proud of you. 20-some-odd
followers and 20-some-odd posts, but I've got more followers than posts, which amazes me.
Michael, Cole gets on Instagram, and he'll post a picture, and he'll put hashtags in it. It's amazing. I'm so proud. I feel like a mother duckling.
That my initial post went ignored
because there was nothing, and I was like, "Cole, honey, sweet summer child, come on now, you gotta do something. People are never gonna find it if you don't."
Does your Instagram link to your Facebook?
No, it isn't. I need to learn that, and
that's what you need to do.
Yeah, we'll work that out.
The Jedi Cole Universe YouTube page will soon have all 10 episodes of Hey Kids Comics Live from back in the Deep Ellum on Air days. So I'm very proud. That was a wonderful...
Are these the old 60s black and white episodes?
Yes.
These are. And
I dressed up like a vampire and sat in front of a fake fire.
Ooh, kids comics.
I was his co-host, Calvin Gulidge.
I was never mind. I'm not. I could take that so many. I'm not gonna do it. All right.
Yes, Master. It's me. Kevin.
It's me. Let me put the tape. Let me put. The- Let me get the movie out of the can and put it on the projector, Master.
I put it on backwards again.
We had good times.
I miss the old horror host.
Yeah. We need to do a special on horror hosts because I had a friend of mine call me. He was in Vegas. Apparently, they still have... Vegas still has a good old-fashioned horror host on one of their local channels on Sunday nights, which is really
God
awesome.
Bless them.
Yeah, we need to do a horror host show. We need to.
There are a few of them around still. Christopher gets his movies on some of these.
Oh,
really?
Yeah, and you know, there's a horror. There's a guy, Dr. Cryptosis. There's another one. What's his name? But yeah, they do things and show his movies and host events, and it's mostly podcast stuff. But then they'll have screening. And show up, and it's like, come see, you know, Dr. Bob with the demon with the atomic brain.
We had Dr. Creep up here, and I miss Dr. Creep so much. That was fantastic. All right, enough. We got to get out of here. We got to let people go to bed.
Yeah, we got to close this one up. I do want to, in closing, say Steve McCauley, who was our guest on the Legion of Superheroes episode. We went over an hour, but we did not exceed like three or four shows prior.
Right. I mean, you guys
were
did a
like
great
15
job.
Minutes
Thank
shy
you, by
of
the way.
Topping out. So.
And for the record, I cut it out, but I did send over research, you jerks. I just sent it over like 4 weeks in advance, and we all forgot I sent it. So.
I never got it.
Oh, Michael, I'll start including you on all the show's research. You can punch it up for me.
That's
right. You can punch up. All right. Next week,
but I have
we
to
talk...
point out that with Steve, we didn't need research.
Oh, no. Of
Much
course
like with
didn't.
Michael. I mean, the second we start mentioning anything, here comes vast layers of knowledge that we had were clueless about, even with our research.
Michael, thank you for coming on and making Cole and I look like a couple of mouth-breathing knuckle-draggers that we are. couldn't appreciate
never,
it
never,
more.
Never.
Do you have any... One thing I want to close this show on right now is, on the comic book side of things, to really explore Batman, to really get into some areas of Batman that maybe most people don't consider or don't know and would like to explore. Do you have any collecteds or story arcs that you would suggest people read?
The Dark Knight Returns.
Always.
I think it's
absolutely.
Just one of the absolute finest pieces of comic art ever done. And as a Batman story, it will give you everything you need to know for a dark, gritty Batman.
Right on. Cole, what about you?
Wow. I think one of the best Batmans that I've seen or encountered, Batman Year One, Batman Year Two.
Yeah.
Especially Batman Year One, because it tells exactly the kind of tale that you need, that gives you a, you know, finding your footing kind of Batman without doing one of the things that I cannot stand in so many media, and that's castrating our heroes. Why must we tell stories where, oh, here's a big superhero story, here's a big whatever story, and then we don't let them do anything?
Yeah. So,
and it gives you that evolution without castrating the character.
That's absolutely true. See, mine would be, and I've talked about it a little bit on the show before, but Batman Snow, if you've never read it, find it, look it up. It's out of print now, but you can still find it digitally, and you can find it in comic shops and sometimes at places like Half Price Books. But it's the story of Batman as he was starting out, no Robin, no real infrastructure built yet, and he builds a group of crime fighters out of everyday citizens, like bodyguards and forensic scientists and people that he can trust, and throws them all in a room together to try to figure out, it's a Mr. Freeze story, to try to figure out where he's going to strike and where he is and his motives. It's a really interesting Batman getting started, trying to understand his dynamic in the world and his desire to include people. You know, that dichotomy of Batman where I want a Robin, but I want to be a loner, or I want to be with the Justice League, or I want to be a loner. The beginnings of that, it's super rad.
So you're essentially, Batman is Mango from Saturday Night Live.
Damn it, Cole. Damn it, Cole.
I'm never speaking to you
Bat
again.
Batmango. Batmango, Cole.
Batmango.
I think that's, there's no better place to leave this show. Buy, collect comic books. What is love? Baby, don't hurt me. Don't hurt me. Batmango. Good night, everybody. Say good night, everybody.
Good night.
Good night, everybody.